Is Rob here?
Oh, I don't know if he's getting ready for that or not.
That's one of the things he's talking to deal with some administrative thing.
Okay.
He's the one who wants to hear this.
He's the one who wants to hear it. Well, we all want to hear it. Most especially.
You don't do it.
Have you
waited for this
thing? It's been a couple of minutes. The only thing is that I guess Rob and I will have to leave at noon, sharp.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we start? He knows the introduction. So today we're very happy that Sumit agreed on short notice to give us a seminar. And it's going to be about programs, time-dependent couplings, and thermalization.
Okay, so I'm going to summarize this this paper. So let me begin with... let me begin with some... the motivation part of it. The motivation, at least for my case, of course, was to understand, which I've been trying to do for quite a while, to understand ADS-CFT correspondence in a time-dependent context. This is the application which originally had in mind, I'm still working on for application topology. But recently, we got interested in this phenomenon, which is called quantum quench. What this really means is to study the effect of a sudden or relatively fast change of coupling in a field theory. So you have a coupling some coupling constant T. G is a function of time in some field theory, and you typically say do something like this. The setup is, for t less than 0, you start with some pure state, psi naught, which can be typically the ground state of some Hamiltonian H naught. And at t, so this is the sudden part of it. And for t greater than 0, you change the Hamiltonian to Hamiltonian, so the different Hamiltonian H, so that this thing is no longer a ground state of this Hamiltonian, it's an excited state of the Hamiltonian, it's going to evolve in unitarily with respect to this. So in reality, what we would like to do is to make this change, instead of having suddenly over a time scale, which is which is much, much smaller than the inverse of the gap in the system. And in a similar way, instead of talking of a pure state psi naught, you could talk of a thermal state whose temperature is much smaller than the gap. And the question which people ask in this subject is, what do the long time correlations look like? Apart from an obvious academic interest in such a situation, because this is a nice non-equilibrium situation to study, this apparently has been, and this is how I came to know about it, has been rather popular in cold atom physics, because in cold atom physics you can do a lot of things. You can change coupling very quickly, whereas in typical quantum matter systems hard to do so, because there's always an environment and the typical time scales which are over which the system can evolve coherently without coupling the environment are not very too short to do anything. Well, I am not going to pretend that I have anything to do with cold atom physics, or for that matter, anything to do with anything real. I'll study this in a completely academic situation, in an academic context. The simplest example, and as you would guess, in fact, the theoretical tools to analyze such a situation directly in field theory are rather limited. But let me just give you some of the results of this rather limited set of theoretical results which have been obtained in this area. And they have been mostly obtained by John Cardy and collaborators. There's a beautiful set of papers by Reed and Cardy and Calabrese, Cardy. Recent papers of the past year, the past couple of years. And one of the simplest examples they analyze is, in fact, almost quite trivial. The simplest thing you can think of, in fact, free bosonic field theory in some number of dimensions. And here is what you do. So here's what you do. You start the system at t less than zero with a mass m naught and a temperature 1/θ0. I'll do this generally for an initial thermal state, and then I'll give the results when the initial state is in fact the vacuum. And at t equal to zero, you change the mass from m naught to m and ask what happened to the state of the system. What I mean by asking what happened to the state of the system, you ask what are, for example, the Feynman-Green's function at late times, which you can obviously calculate. This is a free field theory, so you can calculate everything. So let me give you the results for very late times, and then I'll give you some results for intermediate time. So this becomes when T1, T2 large, and T1 minus T2 finite, an integral right integral like that. becomes, give you the equation, where omega k is standard k-square plus m-square, and beta k is an object which you can calculate, is given by the following expression. Where omega 0 k is the same object with m naught, if you look at this expression, you immediately recognize this is a Fourier transform of a thermal propagator. You can see the characteristic Bose distribution function here. The first part is the zero temperature part, and this body obtained by Swami Bhagavatamastuvara frequencies. You might wonder how come this is only a function of T1 minus T2. The fact is that it is not. It becomes a function of T1 minus T2 only in the limit when T1 and T2 is large. In fact, very soon I will make comments about what happens in that regime when you approach this for finite values of T1 and T2.
That would have been the case if beta was just the temperature. Just since I interrupted, when we started with M0 and we went to M, could we increase or decrease, or did we just...
You can increase or decrease, okay, as you wish. So as Ra of course pointed out, it is not really a thermal propagator, the whole thing is not, because beta k is a function of k. So what these authors say, it's thermal in a sense, it's almost like every momentum has a different temperature. Now that sounds very weird. It wouldn't happen in an interacting field theory. If the theory was interacting, all the modes would have interacted with each other and would eventually thermalize. But this is a free field theory, and so that's in fact just an artifact of the free field approximation. Another comment is that I did not write the term which involves T1, which involves a combination T1 plus T2. It's a complicated mess. I could write it down if you like. But I'll just make a comment that, of course, it's a sum of our harmonic oscillators. And, of course, if there was a single harmonic oscillator, nothing would happen. It would just oscillate. And, however, what happens when you sum over the momenta, as you would do in a field theory, that these oscillatory parts, which involve the cosine of omega k times t1 plus t2, average out to zero, leaving out with this answer. Let me just write down the...
Can I just understand what they said? If there had been interactions, their intuition is, or they showed that...
No. There is a recent paper a few months back where they do some perturbation theory analysis where they show that something like this is happening, but there's no demonstration really.
Okay.
Okay, the two things I would like to point out. So if the initial state has a zero temperature, you still have a beta of k, which is given by this expression. There's many interesting limits, but I'll just concentrate on a few cases. Now, this kind of thing in the general context is most interesting when you have what is called a critical evolution. Namely, you start out from in a system
where relevant operators are away from the critical point, and then you suddenly quench the system to its critical point. Okay, so typically a quantum critical point. So this is sort of mimicked in this free field example by starting with M0 not equal to 0 and M is equal to 0, in which case, if you look at the long distance correlation functions at late times, they will be basically governed by the k equal to 0 part of this correlation function. So you can sort of write down what the beta at k equal to 0 in this case. It just happens to be 4 upon M0. This is T0, not equal to 0. And this just, of course, becomes 4 upon M0 when T0 is equal. You can also calculate, do the Fourier transform and try to obtain the real space correlation functions, which is typically difficult. But in certain cases, it is possible. And the one interesting case is, in fact, D equal to 1. So we are looking at a 1 plus 1 dimensional system. And then what you find in D equal to 1, T0 equal to 0, and for large M0, the result is particularly simple. If you compute the basically what you do is you look at momenta, this is sum over momenta, you look momenta much, much smaller than that m naught. Just that. So it's a kind of infrared limit. Actually, let me not write down this answer. Let me not tell the answer for the nice operators. If you look for the so if you look at the operators which are like I Q phi R T, this is for finite times. By finite times, I have not taken this limit. I'm considering still T1 and T2 finite. So this thing will, this is equal time correlator at a separation, a spatial separation. And
I want to study now in this case what happens when in the large time limit. How does it relax in the large time limit? And so let me give you that answer in that limit. It turns out to be there is a sharp distinction between t less than r upon 2 and t greater than r upon 2. There's some interpretation of that of quasi-particles traveling at the speed of light inside the null cone. And as you can see that there is this exponential dependence. The reason why I computed for d equal to 1 these operators, because these are, of course, the nice conformal operators in the critical limit. And this actually shows something interesting, because Cardi and collaborators have managed to compute correlation functions of conformal operators in such a situation, in a quantum quench situation, in a general 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory by using techniques of boundary conformal field theory. And the general CFT results are, you can see that the dimension of the operator is appearing here, q square. And the general CFT results are, if I take y equal time correlators, where delta is the conformal dimension of this operator and tau naught is a scale which sort of tells you how far you are from the critical point. Okay. In this case, this m naught is a measure for the free field theory of how far you are from the critical point. So in general, they introduce a certain constant tau naught, which sort of quantifies that.
See, particles in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and if you just disturb it, wouldn't it just propagate?
Yeah, it propagates at the speed of light. I think so. That's what this thing. I think it's a very rough, picture. I don't think it has much meat to it. Okay. So the interesting thing which they pointed out is that there's a relaxation time scale,
which is obvious from these two relationships,
which is given by tau naught by pi delta. Of course, tau naught is a non-universal quantity. The way you go out away from a critical point is your choice of what you turn on to what kind of relevant operators you turn on. So this is a non-universal quantity. But if I take two such operators and calculate the relaxation times and the ratios of those, they are given by ratios of the conformal dimensions. So that's a universal quantity. So then the hope is that as one studies these more and more, one will be able to identify a host of universal quantities in this game. The subject is pretty much theoretical, pretty much in its infancy.
You're saying that if I add any interaction, any arbitrary interactions, it is still going to be that.
No. This is a general conformal field theory, an interaction field theory. This result is consistent with this free field theory result. We just recognize that tau naught is just one of them. Okay.
Apart from conformal field theory and free field theory, there are several other studies of this. I mean, there are studies in some spin chains where you quench magnetic fields suddenly and, you know, study things like this. And there are, of course, numerical studies in this game. So our idea was that does ADS-CFT teach us anything about this? Can we learn anything from ADS-CFT in this? Of course, the most interesting situation involves phase transitions where you pass through critical points, and that's difficult to do. We wanted to get something which has some component which is analytical, I mean, rather than an entirely numerical component. So I'll tell you what we managed to do, and I think that's sort of interesting because it throws light on thermalization. In fact, this kind of thing has already been studied in ADS-CFT. And let me remind you this is not going to work. I don't want discrimination against short people. I would have imagined in a place like this, there will be all kinds of buttons which make these things go up and down, but apparently there aren't. Like, well, in Princeton there is, I mean, I don't know. So let me remind you of the situations where, in fact, I would say that this kind of thing has already been studied. The situation corresponds, for example, if I take ADS space, this is the boundary, and what you do is you turn on a dilaton field in the bulk. Goes to some phi naught of t, so that's a coupling constant of the theory on the boundary. So think of ADS 5 cross S 5, so this is related to the coupling of the boundary. And so you can choose the top coupling of the boundary, so that's like the non-normalizable part of the dilaton. And suppose I choose it like that, where at early times the top coupling is very large, it dips down to a small value and, you know, comes back to a large value. This is the kind of situation which we have been studying with Narayan, Ghosh, Awatho, and Trivedi, because the region where the coupling becomes very small is also the region in the bulk which corresponds to, you know, the string frame curvatures becoming very large. It's sort of mimicking some kind of space-like singularity. And you ask the question, I mean, is there a smooth time evolution across this? So there are lots of studies about this. This of course is motivated, but to try to understand regions which are away from the supergravity limit. But there are also studies where you stay in the supergravity limit and do again something like this, or maybe even something like that. For the coupling constant. So instead of bang the boundary, and you ask what happens in the bulk, a purely supergravity question. So this question has been studied by Chesler and Yaffe. Sorry, Chesler didn't study this. So they had a boundary metric which is time dependent, which is a similar situation, and by Bhattacharya and Meenwala, who ask a similar question in various forms of ADS. The question to ask here is that, so what happens to this disturbance which you have created by banging the thing on the boundary? Does a black hole form? Does the thing rattle around in ADS and just become, does it at all thermalize? So that was the question. And so let me just mention to you the result for global ADS. So what happens is that, as you would expect, that if the variation of the coupling is too slow, and this is something what we found as well in our studies, if that when the variation of the coupling is too slow, nothing in particular happens. No black hole is formed. Whereas when the coupling constant variation is fast enough, these authors could show the formation of an apparent horizon, which eventually, I mean, with a suitable form, which eventually evolves into an event horizon. So that's a signature of a thermalization which is happening in the field theory, or the dual description of thermalization. What we will do is to do something similar to this, but in possibly a simpler setup. I mean, this, I would, you would imagine, is a...
These people did it for 3 plus 1 with the boundary Dirac's function of time. I think these people did it with 4 plus 1. This is ADS. ADS 3 plus 1. They did it for ADS problems.
There's something, well, there's someone, I did something, it's actually my first paper.
Very
little time. It was a very similar result. Yeah.
Okay. So what we will do is
a slightly different setup, since I've been exactly at 12, so let me speed up. Supergravity equations are, of course, difficult to analyze. So we do something simpler. We consider probe brains in ADS 5 cross S5 geometries. So if probe brains of various kinds, you can consider D7s or D5s or D3s or D1s. I'll give you partial results from each of these, which are embedded in suitable embeddings in ADS 5 cross S5. The ADS 5 cross S5 is at zero temperature, and placing these brains, of course, in the dual field theory, they correspond to introducing some hypermultiplet fields in the original n equal to 4 theory. So typically, the theories which they lead to are defect conformal field theories. In this case, there is no defect, it's just a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. This case corresponds to a 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. This case corresponds to 1 plus 1 dimensional theory. And the D1 case corresponds to 0 plus 1 dimensional theory. What we're going to find are solutions of the probe grains, which carry some angular momentum in the S5, which are rotating in a typically non-uniform fashion. In some direction of S5. Depending on the situation, this kind of solution, the solutions would have a non-normalizable component, which means that there are certain sources which I have set up in the field theory, which are functions of time. And what are the sources, of course, depends on what kind of brains which you consider. For example, for D7 brains, they correspond to a time-dependent mass, which is, something for a constant angular velocity. It's kind of phase of the mass which is changing, For the D5 brains, we can actually have a situation where this is, even the magnitude is some function of time. So the mass itself is changing pretty close to the Cardi situation. I'll tell you a little bit more about this later. And in this case, this is some coupling, which I'll write down in the Hartree multiplex sector, which have been worked out by other people. Becomes a function of time. Okay. What we will find, so let me give you the results. What we will find that in a large variety of these situations, I'll tell you later, we didn't quite study the supersymmetric embedding of that. We studied the T-dual of this thing, which is a non-supersymmetric embedding. So that's very similar to this kind of thing, but it has some additional interesting features because you can study things with an additional gauge field on the D3 brain. So you can compute AC conductivities, which have behaviors which are quite characteristic. In a large class of these situations, what we find is that the brain wall volume, the induced metric, develops apparent horizons. Of course, if the apparent horizon is evolving very fast, then it is very difficult to say anything about, you know, what's going on. But in some approximation, when the apparent horizon is, you know, evolving slow enough, you can associate a local temperature with the apparent horizon. It's just got to do with the fact that if you look at the solutions of the wave equation near an apparent horizon, then the outgoing waves near the horizons acquire imaginary part of the phase, you know, that which is typical of the Hawking phenomena. So there is some temperature which you can associate with this. So this leads to a temperature. What does the temperature do? I mean, who sees this temperature? Of course, the So if you look for fluctuations around these classical solutions, their correlators will expect it to develop a thermal characteristic. Now, there is a fact here which is a little bit different from what you might expect. If you want to ask, when does the system really thermalize, that means it sort of really has a stationary state which is characterized by a temperature. In these situations, you change the Dirac for a finite amount of time and then let it go. What happens is that from the field theory point of view, you have introduced some energy into the system. The energy gets distributed among the modes and thermalizes. So, I mean, at late times, you don't have any varying dilaton or invarying coupling, and you have a thermal situation in terms of a constant temperature. What that corresponds to in the bulk is that the apparent horizon, which is formed during the time when the things are actually changing with time, becomes asymptotic to an event horizon, and the event horizon is characterized by a normal Hawking temperature. In our cases, what we find, however, that the apparent horizon evolves into into an event horizon when the asymptotic spin is constant. That means the D brain is rotating asymptotically with a constant spin. And the reason why we think this is happening is because of this probe approximation which we're using. Because in the probe approximation, what we are considering is a kind of an open system. The thing that is thermalizing, the correlators in the field theory which would acquire thermal characteristics are the correlators which only involve the hypermultiplet sector. But the very nature of the probe approximation, it doesn't do anything to the vector multiplet. In supergravity, this means that we are ignoring the back reaction of this rotating brains onto the supergravity background. So it would be natural to believe that if we do include the back reaction, which you have no idea how to do, you would in fact get a situation where you turn off the time dependence at late times and the system will thermalize. But that's not something which we see in our cases. So let me give you some concrete examples and formulas of how this thing happens. And in fact, most of the physics is captured by the case of D1 brains, so which I'll do in a little bit of detail and make the corresponding comments for the D5 brains, for the other D5s and D3s and so on. The D1 is nice because everything can be analytically done. I've become very good at this. Oh, I can even use this. No. So D1 brains in ADS5 process. Okay, so we're going to use a form of a bulk metric, which is a slightly general than ADS, standard form Curry ADS5 process 5, for reasons which will become clear. So there are three of these. And let me choose the S5. So this function f of r is r square for Poincaré patch. It's going to be 1 plus r square and x to be replaced by omega 3 for a global ADS. So it's a nice unified way of doing this. It is useful, as always, because we are trying to do some causal physics. We are sort of banging some three. We have to try to find solutions. Let me say what kind of solutions we're going to find. We're going to find solutions as a function of T and R, but which are causal. What this means, these solutions have a non-zero support at R equal to infinity, which is the boundary. And so that's like a source which is on the boundary, so to bang the source, and the disturbance travels into the bulk in a causal fashion. So it's useful to use causal coordinates. So use the Erichter-Finkelstein coordinates. T plus or minus this thing. And without any further ado, we're using ingoing Erichter-Finkelstein. So V and R. I'll not write down what the metric becomes. It's trivial. But I'll write down what the action becomes. And so we find classical solutions with theta frozen to pi upon 2, all other coordinates frozen to some constant values. This is the only thing which changes, and you get an action which is like this. Of course, this is a complicated action with a complicated equation of motion, but quite remarkably, it's not very hard to check. First of all, let me just point out that in the linearized approximation, that means in the quadratic approximation for the S, the factor of F of R cancels, and it just becomes a free massless scalar field, minimally coupled massless scalar field. And that would have a solution which is any function of u plus any function of v. Okay? In the general case, I mean, for general nonlinear theory, it's not very hard to check that that the following, this is not the most general solution, but the solutions any phi such that or, but not both. You cannot take a linear combination anymore because it's a nonlinear theory. So we're going to take solutions which are like this, so that means phi is only a function of v, which is might as well because v, say, in Poincaré coordinates, v is like t minus 1 upon r, so this is like the retarded time, which becomes the regular time on the boundary. So anything which is a function of v, if I just put boundary conditions on that, it just propagates in a causal fashion. Given any solution of phi of v, and you can choose anything you like, you can calculate what is the induced metric on the boundary. The coordinates on the boundary are, of course, r and v, because the string is stretched along the r direction, it has the time, and the transverse coordinates are the vector x, thetas, phis, and the omega 3s. So this has an apparent horizon. This is like a Vidomet type of metric. Collapsing shells or variating shells. And if there's an apparent horizon, if this thing is valid, I'm just ignoring signs here. Oh, it's called square. Sorry. If this thing has a solution for real R, now for Poincaré patch, f of R is just R square, so this is just R equal to the magnitude of del V of phi, so there is always an apparent horizon. Now suppose phi of V is going like that. What is the dual of turning on a field like this? So what that corresponds to, so in the let me just briefly say, in the field theory, what the presence of the D1 brains means is that there are two complex hypermultiplets. So of course it represents a monopole, in the n equal to 4 theory. And it introduces two complex scalars, which I'll call Q and Q tilde. And Diaconescu has worked out the couplings in this particular context, in this theory, in the 0 plus 1 dimensional theory. And turning on this corresponds to having a source term, which looks like that. Plus Q, where this is one of the scalars of the n equal to 4 theory. Which scalar? This is the scalar, this is a complex scalar. The two components are the two Cartesian coordinates in the plane on which the D1 brain is rotating. You know, that the phi is an angle on some two plane, and it is that scalar. So what you would like to see is, if you have, say, phi. Now, on the boundary, v is the same as t, because v is t minus 1 upon r, r equal to infinity is the boundary. So if I have a phi of v, which sort of looks like that, so it's like, you know, it started out to be a constant. Any constant is a solution, and then there was a change to a different value of that constant. You can see that the apparent horizon forms and then recedes away. You know, there's always a Poincaré horizon at r equal to infinity, and in that intermediate region, so this horizon comes inside and then recedes away. However, if the thing is like that, so that asymptotically phi of v is omega times v, then there is an event horizon R equal to omega. And there's a characteristic Hawking temperature with the event horizon, which is given by omega upon 2 pi. Okay. If you want to know what this solution actually looks like, in the plane in which it is rotating, it's actually sort of looks like this. It sort of wraps around many, many times near the horizon. In fact, if you calculate the energy, I'll just say this in words, if you calculate the energy of this thing, you'll find that it is infinite. It's not in, this one infinity always comes because it's an infinitely long string. But that you can regulate by ending the string on a D7 brain to give it some mass. But there's an infinity which actually comes from the R equal to zero Poincaré horizon. That in the infinity, we believe, comes from the fact that there's a, and if you analyze the energy momentum tensor and the flow of the energy momentum tensor, what you find, there's a constant rate of energy which flows in from the ultraviolet boundary into the infrared, and that energy is sort of going into the bulk. So really speaking, in that region, you cannot ignore the back reaction anymore. And so because of this, we believe that what possibly happens is that, you know, if you take into account the back reaction, a little black hole is formed near R equal to 0. For global coordinates, where f of r is 1 plus r square, so for global, there is a horizon. So in the case of a constant spin, for phi equal to omega v, only if omega is greater than 1. That is sort of expected because the global theory has a mass gap, and you've got to spin it fast enough so that you thermalize the thing. And the energy is, in fact, finite. There's nothing pathological about it. For the global case, there's actually a string which goes from one end of the boundary to its antipodal end, and the energy is flowing from one, from the in the field theory picture, there are just two points on an S3, and energy is flowing from one point to another point. Okay, I just got 10 minutes. So let me tell you, what does this lead to? So as I said, what this would be visible if I calculate the physics of fluctuations around the solutions. Now, if you work out, it's a long and but easy calculation. The action for fluctuations of this thing . What you find is that if I denote the transverse coordinates by generically yi, so I runs over x, the three x's, theta, phi, and the omega 3. R is the thing around which the D string is. What you find is, of course, there is a string tension. This is the induced metric. It's a nice answer, which is a function of, this is the classical solution. So because this Gij is the metric in the transverse space, for example, if I take the I to be one of the x directions, this Gij is r squared. Okay? And r is one of the coordinates here, so this is dr dt. So in general, the equation of motion for these fluctuations could be a bit complicated. It turns out that other people have solved it in very different contexts. The equation for the fluctuations of phi itself are very easy. They're just a minimally coupled massless scalar. So given that, of course, you can calculate correlators. So let me just give you the answer for the mean square displacement of the end point of the string. This is an interesting quantity which people have looked at also in the ADS-CFT context. I have not even thought. So what you want to calculate is the following quantity. So y phi is the fluctuations. So suppose I calculate this object. The U stands for the Unruh vacuum, the metric on the in which these fluctuations live have a horizon. So there's many different vacuums you can choose. So this is the Unruh vacuum, which is the Schwarzschild vacuum for ingoing and the Kruskal vacuum for outgoing. Anyway, so this is a standard quantity which you sort of compute. What you find, you can I'll not write down the exact answer, but it's sort of useful to write down the limits. This you can recognize immediately as a classic result for Brownian motion. For small times, it's what's called a ballistic behavior. I mean, x square goes as t square, so x goes as t. And for long times, it's an Einstein behavior of x square going as t. So this is in the phi direction. You can calculate similar things for the x directions. And there, what you would expect is that it's in the string itself has, if it extends all the way to the boundary, it has an infinite mass, so nothing should really happen. So you got to end the string on actually another rotating D7 bend, which you can do, and then it has a finite mass, and the mass enters into the formula. So let me just give you the answer for the x fluctuations. The same answers are, again, a ballistic behavior, where this is the infrared mass which you have put for T. So in particular, when the mass is large, this is again the Hawking temperature which appears here. When the mass is very large, you never get into the Brownian regime. It's always a ballistic regime. Now, this, of course, has been observed in the past, in particularly by De Boer, Rangamani, Ubeni collaborators, and by Son, Dan Son, and others, where they looked at the fluctuations of a string in a background geometry, which is an ADS black hole. Okay? And there, the interpretation was that, you know, the thermal environment of the ADS black hole, it sort of leads to, because the presence of a horizon in the bulk leads to a presence of a horizon in the induced world sheet of the string. That causes Hawking radiation, which makes the string flap around, and what you're seeing here is the effect at the end point of the string. We don't have a black hole in the bulk. In the bulk, it's just, you know, standard time equal, temperature equal to zero. What we have instead is a non-trivial classical solution, time-dependent classical solution. And what we find is that when that solution is such that it sort of asymptotically comes with a constant field, it sort of mimics the effect of a thermal environment. Okay. I've just 2 minutes, so let me summarize the results. Some other signatures of this emergence of thermalization which happens. skip. Okay, so another signature of this thing, the fact that there is some effective temperature which is arising into the game, is you take this this D1 drain solution and you do a T duality in two of the x directions. So you get a D3 brain. It's not the standard embedding of the D3 brain in D5, but nevertheless, it's a D3 brain. But then there is a non-trivial gauge field on the D3 brain. This gauge field is the gauge field of the baryon number U1, you know, the U1 of the brain itself. So what you can find are rotating D3 brain solutions. So rotating D3 brain plus an electric field in the R direction. You can find solutions of the coupled equations, and that's what we found. And then you can ask, what in this background, what are the fluctuations of, say, the x component of the vector potential? So if you take x component of the vector potential with some frequency, this is a small perturbation around this. So using standard ADS CFT technology, you can calculate the retarded Green's function of this thing. And from the retarded Green's function, you can read off the AC conductivity, which is just related to the retarded Green's function by a factor of the frequency. And you cannot calculate that, so Tadashi's students calculated that numerically. And I'll just give you the picture because it shows you something interesting. So this is the real part of the AC conductivity that has a behavior that goes like that, typically like this. And this is the imaginary part of this thing. Now, this is, of course, there have been lots of studies of AC conductivities in ADS CFT in various contexts. And very often, for example, the ones which use ADS, charged ADS black holes, what one finds is that there is a delta function peak of the real part of sigma, which has, you know, got to do with some kind of relaxation time going to infinity. But this is very much, very classical. This is very close to what we have in a Drude model, because this is a typical kind of behavior which you get in a Drude model. Again, showing this AC conductivity, sort of showing that there is, you know, some kind of thermalization which has happened. I've come to the end of my time, so I'll just mention that there are similar situations which you can have for. So I should talk just a little bit about Quent, of where I've begun. The solutions which are like this is, of course, not like a Quent. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, having an asymptotic value at late times. But you can also look at, since phi can be any function of V, you can look at solutions at Quent. And then, as I said, what you would find is that the apparent horizon develops, and so in terms of pictures, there is a. So this is R equal to 0. This is R equal to infinity on the boundary. So this is, suppose that you have a phi of V which has, you know, some kind of behavior which is localized around V equal to 0. Just like a little pulse. So this is, roughly speaking, a pulse which is sort of going in like this. At some value of R, there is an apparent horizon. So what you can calculate the effect of that, there will be some Hawking particles, this is time, Hawking particles which are emitted at the apparent horizon, so they will travel to the boundary along, you know, the null geodesics, and so the temperature which you will see on the boundary is the temperature which is connected to the apparent horizon at an earlier time, by exactly the time delay of the time taken for the signal to go from the apparent horizon to the boundary. So you can calculate an effective temperature on the boundary for such a situation. And what you find is that if you plot the temperature as a function of time, it, as expected, is goes to zero. It should go to zero because, as we concluded, the apparent horizon recedes back to R equal to infinity. So there, at late time, there should be nothing. But it goes to zero with an asymptotic behavior which just goes universally, like 2 upon time. which is sort of expected. It's like a conformal field theory. So towards the end, when nothing has happened, it will just follow the scaling dimension. That's a good check on our calculations. So to end, I said that we have examples of situations like this with D5 brains and D7 brains. They have been obtained numerically by using standard techniques. I mean, I know the technique, but I didn't do the numerical work. I mean, that's what my collaborators did. And they sort of, again, sort of give more credence to this general scenario that by turning on a set of time-dependent couplings or time-dependent masses in the boundary theory, you can achieve something like thermalization. The interesting thing to do, which we cannot do and which we're thinking at the moment, is to do such things, such changes across critical points, because that's when you may get some universal signatures and universal behaviors. I should also say that it's actually also interesting to do this kind of thing not just for a rapid change of the couplings, but even for a slow change of the couplings, particularly around critical points, because at the critical point, the gap goes to zero, so there has to be some failure of adiabaticity, which people have looked at in the past in the concept of cosmology. This is called the Keeble-Zurek mechanism, formation of defects. So there is an analogous thing, which is, again, very popular in the condensed matter community, to study these things, and it would be nice. I mean, the whole point is that this is not supposed to model anything real. We don't have that audacity to say things like that. But it is something in an area where the theoretical tools are extremely limited. So anything you learn from this will possibly be useful. I'm sorry. I think I took 1 hour, but I think... Thank you.
It matches actually, the two answers match.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. So the.
So it's convenient?
Yes. I think the derivative is not.
C0 but not C1, right?
No, so.
Reflectiveness.
Yeah, it smoothly connects.
Okay,
to the
it's smooth.
Yeah. There's no discontinuity of the green function.
Why is there no oscillation in time in those formulas? You said they're for finite time. I would expect some oscillations in the answer, which then decay at late time.
So this is finite and late times. The initial oscillations have been taken off from these answers. So the time is late, but not that late enough that everything has gone to zero.
Oh, it's late enough, yes.
Late enough, right. There are, of course, oscillations. There's a cosine there, actually.